Hello, everyone. I'm Michael Nicoletis for Real Vision. Today with us, we have John Floyd, head of macro strategies at Record Currency Management. And hello, John. How are you?
Very good. Good afternoon, Michael. It's nice to be here on Real Vision.
Nice to be with you, too. So if you can you give us a bit of your background so the viewers can see where you're coming from and what your experience has been before we start talking about the global macro and more specifically about Turkey?
Absolutely. So I am the head of portfolio management and macro strategies at Record Currency Management. Previously, I ran a absolute return currency fund for over 15 years. What I've done is bring my currency for return fund under the umbrella of Record. And we've also started a macro fund on July 1. And I would just also say before we start that the views here are the views of the macro strategies unit, not necessarily all of Record Currency Management. We have a number of different portfolios that we construct and manage for various clients, but these are for the currency for return and macro strategies.
Great. So let's talk about, first of all, how you see the world, how you see the macro setup, and what opportunities you've seen, and how do you think this thing is going to play out?
Look, I think, Michael, as we discussed yesterday in kind of the pre-call, the key thing to look at and the way we structure the portfolio is we look at what's happening on a long-term basis on both a macroeconomic and geopolitical framework. And we've developed a number of proprietary scorecards and methods to analyze that framework. And from there, look on a more short-term nature as to how best to express that view, what instruments, where, what country, what products. In doing that, we came up with a number of different trades in emerging markets, one of them being Turkey, others being South Africa and Brazil. And when I shared this with Raul, we thought this would be a good point to kind of discuss where we are now in the world and how we came to these conclusions and perhaps how to express these views. And I think one of the overriding factors is recognizing how we came into 2020. And one of the key themes was that we've had an explosion in debt. Where debt as a percentage of GDP has risen from about 100% in 1950 to 220% coming into 2020. The pandemic or COVID-19 really was a catalyst. Just, you know, viruses expose the weak points. Just as if you're playing a game of checkers or you're playing a game of chess and you have a knight running around unsupported, or you open up a hole in your checker position, the virus opened a weak spot in the global economy. And one of the studies that we came across very early was a study, I believe, out of UCal Irvine that the San Francisco Fed picked up. And if you look at pandemics going back over multiple centuries, you see that pandemics tend to depress real rates of return for prolonged periods of time, you know, 10 plus years. So I think when you look through that and you think about what's happening now in September of 2020, you look at the response from the central banks and from the fiscal authorities, and you look at some of the contemporaneous data in context with how we came into this crisis. I think we're at a turning point now where the dollar is going to rally. The dollar is not going to lose its reserve currency stance anytime. If you look at the spreads between mobility indicators in the U.S. and Europe, they're moving in the U.S.'s favor right now. The ECB this week is likely to recognize the strength in the euro and its downward impact on inflation, in addition to some of the inflation indicators we've seen come out over the past few weeks. The U.S. election now has, the race has clearly tightened, where I think it's more likely that President Trump wins the race. It's a little unclear what happens in both houses of Congress. And I think if you look at the positioning indicators, clearly they're slanted to people being short the dollar and long the euro. Now, if you take this in context of the emerging markets, it's amazing to me that despite the dollar's weakness, many of the emerging markets have not rallied. So if you think about if the dollar rallies and you have structural weaknesses in some of the emerging markets, these currencies, along with a decline in the V-shaped recoveries over the next few months, I think we can see 10%+ depreciations, if not larger moves, as we recalibrate what the growth trajectory is going to look like globally for the next year.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
So just to recap a bit what you said, the statement that the virus was a trigger and not the cause of the problem, you agree with that statement that things have occurred because it was a trigger. The COVID-19 did not cause this whole situation we're in right now. Is this something?
Absolutely. This was going to happen one way or the other. You know, you never are quite sure exactly what the catalyst is going to be. We can see it in hindsight. All we can do is set up a picture of what we see in terms of the macroeconomic outlook, what the geopolitical outlook is, and probabilistically how we think it might evolve and where the weak points are. But we're never quite sure exactly what it's going to be.
Okay, and the second thing is, you believe the dollar is going to go higher. I tend to agree with the thesis, but we've seen during the past few months the dollar weakening significantly across a broad basket of currencies. Obviously, there are those who believe that the dollar might go lower. I tend to agree with your statement that the dollar should go higher just because, in my view, it's the cleanest shirt around, not because it's a good currency or not, but there are more problems in other currencies than the dollar. So I think that the dollar should go higher. Now, what is interesting in what you said is that usually when the dollar weakens, emerging market currencies tend to do well. In this case, there are some cases where even though the dollar has weakened, some emerging market currencies have not done well. So EM currencies, some EM currencies have done poorly even though the dollar has been weakening. Which currencies are that? Which one are you looking at? And why do you think this has happened? Because if your thesis is right and the dollar starts rallying, imagine what the EM currencies, which have been weakening during a weak dollar, what will happen then?
It's a great point. And I think that's really one of the salient points in terms of thinking how the markets may evolve from here, particularly in EM. This really is not that different than what's happened over the past 10 or 15 years in global asset markets, if you think about it, right? We've had one of the greatest financial booms ever in history. And in this period of time, you know, US CapEx, for example, and productivity has declined as financial engineering has taken over. In the same way, many of the emerging market economies came into this crisis with a relatively weak position, because their debt levels have risen, right? So we talked earlier about global debt levels rising, particularly dollar debt in emerging markets.
Do you have an estimate of what the dollar debt in EM is, approximately?
Yeah, don't quote me exactly, but it's roughly $4 trillion, I believe.
Okay.
But global debt, you know, as a percentage of GDP, is around 220. And in countries like Brazil, they came into this crisis with debt to GDP at around 80%. That's likely to go north of 100%. The budget deficit is blowing out to around 15% of GDP. In Turkey, there are negative reserves when you account the liabilities in the banking system.
Can you elaborate a bit on that? Because most people will say negative reserves. How can that happen? They don't understand what the Turkish Central Bank has done. So if you can, you know, say a few words on that, I think people will find it very interesting.
Sure, sure. Look, I think one of the slightly outcomes of the slightly unorthodox policy in Turkey has been, in order to defend the currency and stop it from depreciating sharply, the central bank has drawn down on the reserves and they've used the Turkish banks to assist in intervening through swap lines. If you take that all into account, it means their actual reserve position is negative, you know, somewhere in the order of minus 20 to 30 billion. Some of the most recent data I looked at prior to this interview has slightly changed that a little bit. And all of it's not up to date. But net, there's liability within the reserves of Turkey.
So effectively, depositor dollar deposits in Turkish banks have been depleted because they've been used by the central bank to defend the currency. Is this
That's correct.
Correct.
That's correct.
Okay. So do you think this could cause also a banking crisis within Turkey? How do you think this plays out going forward? Because if Turkey right now is having negative reserves, and if I'm correct, today the lira went around 7.49 or 7.50 versus the dollar. I think it's a new low, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct.
It means that the currency is falling gradually at this moment, because I guess the central bank is intervening. But if they have negative reserves, this cannot hold for long. It means that they will need either dollars, I would think of via swap lines via the Fed, if that were to occur, because as we speak, this isn't happening. This is the Fed hasn't given swap lines to the Turkish Central Bank. Or if that doesn't happen, how do you think this, what do you think happens from going forward?
I think, Michael, those are all the absolute right questions. I would turn it slightly differently and in some ways view this as an opportunity, a window of opportunity for Turkey to come out on top here. I had a conversation about 2 weeks ago with the deputy head of one of the largest emerging market countries' central banks. And he made a very obvious but somewhat startling admission when I asked him about the pass-through of currency depreciation to the inflation rate. And he said, it's there, but our output gaps in terms of the demand shock that we've seen from COVID-19 is so large, it's barely impacting us right now. And he wasn't very concerned about it. And I think, unlike the euro, which those countries are in a straitjacket where they have severe limitations on what can be done fiscally and monetarily to stimulate individual economies, and where Italy now is less competitive than it was when it entered the euro, Turkey has a great opportunity here to use COVID-19 and the pandemic and the current environment to its benefit, using the output gaps, using COVID-19 and the shocks to GDP, letting the currency depreciate. There will be definitely some pass-through to inflation given the open economy. keeping rates relatively firm, hopefully getting them positive right now because real rates are negative. And through doing this, through a weaker currency, through higher real rates, there's a very good chance that, one, the export economy will become more competitive. Two, they will attract capital into the country. And that ultimately could be an advantage for Turkey that many countries, like the euro, doesn't have right now. The alternative, in terms of, you know, potential shocks, like what could go wrong and cause a massive appreciation to Turkey, possibly swap lines from the Fed, possibly an IMF package, possibly some unilateral support from the U.S. But I think these are low probability bets right now. They may occur further down the road in a time of crises, but they're a ways off right now.
Very interesting points. Question, but isn't the fact that right now Turkish corporates are borrowed a lot in dollars, I think the next 12 months they need to repay something around $100 billion, wouldn't a weakening currency make this repayment harder and cause some issues in the internal economy? I understand completely that once the currency, let's say, devalues, it helps exports and growth can come from abroad. Given that we've seen that COVID cases have been coming up again and we might have a second wave, and that second wave might cause again a slowdown in the economy. First, is that external growth coming for Turkey? Second, do you think that if the currency falls, what's more important, exports going up or some companies not being able to pay their debt because of the currency fall? And third, how do you think the banks are affected in this matrix where they've lent money in the Turkish corporates, they're vulnerable from all sides, and their deposits have been used to defend the currency? So to sum it up, I hear your points, and I think they're very valid. I'm not sure who wins this tug of war in terms of Turkey being better off on the next day. Or maybe, let me put it this way, maybe we have a short-term crisis. I don't want to put crisis, but a short-term, let's say, pressure on the economy. But then what you just said plays out. The sequence of events is a bit more troubling for me. I don't know how you see this.
Look, I mean, there is no doubt it's a very challenging situation. And the numbers are the numbers. You know, rates are negative. Real rates are negative. Credit has been exploding. Real reserves are negative. The dollar liabilities are there. The geopolitical uncertainty is there and is rising on multiple fronts, as you well know, being in Athens. It's with Greece. It's with Russia. It's with the U.S. Name a spot. There is significant geopolitical uncertainty that is rising as opposed to falling. And it's a challenging situation to get out of. If you break down, another interesting fact, and this fits into some of the themes on Real Vision of Bitcoin and gold. I broke down the balance of payments and the errors and admissions. Interestingly, this is in terms of when you look at the balance of payments, you look at the current account, you look at the capital account, and you see where the flows are. And one of the big challenges in Russia in 1998 was that the errors and emissions were particularly high because there's a lot of flight capital. If you look at the past few quarters in Turkey, the errors and emissions show a significant amount of flight capital out of the country, some of which, given restrictions and monitoring, is probably going into things like Bitcoin.
Okay, very interesting. That's why I guess gold has been going up, a gold reserve. I think they've been purchasing gold within Turkey, if I'm not mistaken. I read somewhere that gold demand had picked up within Turkey. Maybe it's a form of flight, of currency flight outside the country. If you can't take it out by a hard asset that doesn't lose its value, I guess.
Correct. Correct. I haven't seen those numbers, but that would make sense in terms of what you're seeing in the detail of the balance of payments. And in terms of what it means, in terms of the dollar liabilities of the Turkish entities, the banks and corporates, it's clearly a risk. But if you look back to late July, when we first started putting on some trades in Turkey, at the time, the lira was kind of pinned through intervention, likely around the 7.0 level. And as you said this morning, it's at 7.5. So the risk is a disorderly depreciation that gets out of control without international support. If you look at the currency since the last crisis in August of 2018, you know, by our calculations on a real effective exchange rate basis, which looks at inflation differentials versus the competitors, Turkey is 10 to 15% overvalued right now, which would imply that it would have to depreciate 10 to 15% from here to be as competitive as it was in August of 2018.
From 750.
That's correct.
And just to let everyone know, I think the Turkish lira was at the beginning of the year around 6, right? It's gone from 6 to 750 within 9 months already.
That's correct.
So it's a pretty sharp depreciation, I would say, for the time frame we're talking about. So the way you would express the trade would be via the currency, or do you have other ways of doing this trade, or how do you see the macro landscape, and what's your risk reward in terms of looking at this, at looking at playing the devaluation in Turkey?
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
513 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Right, right. That, A, is always a challenging question. B, it's particularly a challenging question in Turkey, given liquidity, given the volatility curves, and given the geopolitical uncertainty and given the negative carry. I think it's always important when you're expressing a trade, as I said, to take a top-down perspective, to think about how you expect the world to evolve from a macroeconomic and geopolitical standpoint, and then to compare how the rest of the world expects the market prices to evolve. And if there's a gap there, you can derive what I would call a variant perception. And in that gap is an opportunity. In Turkey, the way we have chosen to express this, given the market dynamics, is to put on dollar call spreads. So put on dollar call spreads where we're buying a dollar call and selling a dollar call at a higher strike in the 3 month to 6 month time period, where we're minimizing some of the decay through the volatility. We're minimizing some of the long vega through being short the options while we're limiting our upside, but we're still generating options where the risk reward is between 5-1 and 10-1 of the premium that we're spending. And we've calibrated the strikes to be roughly in line for maximum profit based off our analysis of previous devaluation periods in Turkey. So if you go back in time over the past 10 or 20 years, you find that the average depreciation of the Turkish lira during periods of weakness is slightly over 30%. So we structure options to derive maximum benefit should that happen with great risk reward. And we're also operating under the belief that and this is the challenge for Turkey and the challenge for the dollar liabilities. markets don't move in a linear fashion. They move in a parabolic fashion. And that's the real risk here, but that's the real payout in our option structures. Now, one of the tenets that, you know, I've always followed is you want to find the most direct expression of an investment view and not get too scattered or die a death of a thousand cuts with 30 different positions when they're all correlated. In the case of Turkey here, you need to call somewhat of what I'd say maybe an audible. You need to be a little diversified, taking into account, and this is what we talked about yesterday, is Turkey is part of a global view that's been evolving for 10 plus years in terms of debt levels, the lack of the emerging market countries to take advantage of the 10-year plus bull market in the world economies, not correcting the fiscal deficits, not addressing the spending issues, not building up reserves for a lot of emerging market countries, not all of them. But also to think about what we mentioned earlier about Europe and thinking about, okay, if Turkey comes under pressure, who else besides the Turkish banks and Turkish corporates might be impacted through feedback mechanisms? You know, the many cases you have a small event, you know, Iceland, you know, the crisis in Iceland one time, you know, kind of the butterfly flapping its wings, you know, led to impact globally. When long-term capital came under pressure because of their some of their positions, that had reverberations throughout the world. In this case, you know, there's a large, if you look through the bank exposure of European banks to Turkey, France and Spain particularly stand out. So going along with the Turkish view, but backing into the flows and liabilities and thinking about our euro view, we've also expressed this trade through short positions in Italian bonds, French bonds, and Spanish bonds versus both the U.S. And German bunds. We've also are expressing this through the euro, through short euro positions.
Very interesting. So you think that if there was a, let's say, a parabolic currency devaluation in Turkey, which would trigger a domestic crisis in Turkey, that the knock-on effect would be first in Europe or in EM, as, you know, the investors would go and look at other EM countries first? Or do you think it would be first, let's go and see France and Italy, their exposures, and hedge or reduce our positions because it could get affected immediately? So, or do you look at both? How do you see this?
Well, I'm not sure of the exact order. My estimate would be that it would be impacted, and just we saw the other day in things like South African Rand and the Mexican Peso. I think the first order effect would be through emerging market currencies, outside of something specific happening in Europe. Now, we know what the European Bank Index has been doing for the past 10 years in terms of kind of pulling, you know, with a very large gravitational pull to lower numbers in terms of share prices. I expect that to continue. This would definitely exacerbate that. But I think the first order effects and the immediate effects would be in the emerging market currencies. The story in South Africa and Brazil are slightly different, right? All these things, you know, you have to kind of paint a picture and see what the weak points are. You know, the weak point in Brazil and South Africa are the fiscal numbers and the dollar debt numbers. The dollar debt numbers in Turkey are high, but not quite as bad as the other countries.
Okay. So let me see if I understood correctly. So you're bearish on Europe, and this makes it an even stronger case for your bearish thesis, or is it a bearish thesis in Europe, which is derived by Turkey?
I would take it one step higher on the global chain.
Okay.
And get back to your earlier point about the dollar and, you know, the best of a bad bunch. I think the dollar is the best of the bad bunch. The U.S. economy is the best of, say, call it a hurting bunch in terms of the impact of COVID-19. You know, we have, the U.S. has the highest potential GDP. It's the largest economy in the world. It's got higher productivity levels than most countries, particularly Europe as a whole. And I think the U.S. will be the leader, and particularly some of the contemporaneous numbers some of the high-frequency indicators we've been modeling point to the U.S. doing better here relative to Europe. And I think you're seeing that in some of the confidence numbers, industrial production numbers, inflation numbers coming out of Europe, as well as the COVID-19 mobility numbers. That leads us to a view on the dollar, the overall issues in Europe and how the euro has evolved since its existence, and the decline in Italian productivity and competitiveness, and the rise in debt levels. And the package that's come out, which was described as a Hamiltonian moment, which I think is as far from the truth as you can get, in that it only addresses 10% of Italy's needs over the next few years. And that 10% is contingent upon meeting certain hurdles which are unlikely to be met. That leads us to a Europe view versus the dollar and a peripheral view within Europe. The linkages and the feedback and mechanisms and what's happening in Turkey idiosyncratically fit into that kind of global food chain of opportunities in terms of how we think the markets are going to evolve.
Okay, so I'm mostly on board with what you're saying, your thesis. I agree. My question is, what could go wrong? What would go wrong in this thesis the way you see it? What should one watch for things going the other way, for example? What would you need to see to change your view?
Mm-hmm. Oh, look, I mean, there's always a lot of things that can go wrong. And part of the game here is and what we've been very good at is structuring a portfolio that is disciplined and focused. And as I said, honing in on what the right questions are and structuring a portfolio that is most directly benefited if you're right. But at the same time, if you're wrong, which happens more times than I can count, minimizing the downside, either through discipline in terms of getting out of positions, or in the case of Turkey, structuring this in the way where you've got great risk reward, but your downside is clearly defined by what you've spent on the options. Now, in terms of what can go wrong, look, the Turkey could get a big investment from a foreign country. Qatar could provide more capital to Turkey. The U.S. could decide Turkey is a great place for us to continue our peace talks in the Middle East. It helps in terms of creating a buffer to Russia. In terms of the euro, perhaps there will be a real Hamiltonian moment. I see that as highly unlikely. Perhaps there are major disruptions in global supply chains and inflation becomes an issue, which I don't think is the case right now. But that's a risk. And the U.S. badly manages that process and inflation spikes and the dollar, which I think will ultimately happen, just not anytime soon. The dollar losing its reserve currency status begins to, accelerate. There's lots of things that can go wrong. There's a constitutional crisis in the U.S. election and people flee the dollar. There's all sorts of things. But I think we have the portfolio structured in the way that we're somewhat insulated and have identified what they could be and know how to react if in fact, those unexpected scenarios happen.
Thank you, John. I think this has been a great analysis, I think, for the viewers of Real Vision. Is there anything else you would like to add, which I'm missing or I haven't thought of asking, let's say? Is it some, because you've structured the trade, you've shown everyone what the downside, the upside is, what could go wrong, and what the benefits of playing a call spread is. I think investors will find very useful. Anything else that you would like to add? Or
I think, Michael, the key thing for investors here at whatever level they're at, retail or institutional level, and the key thing that we are focused on in the portfolio and structuring investments is that by any stretch, whether in terms of us doing, you know, an interview here now on Skype at our homes and wearing masks, or looking at the global debt numbers or the fiscal numbers, we're in an extraordinary environment, and that is likely to lead to extraordinary price adjustments in the global financial markets. And currencies, for me, you know, I was giving a talk about a year ago in Alberta, Canada, and at the time, given where monetary policy was, you know, gravitating towards zero, and given where equity valuations were, you know, I coined a phrase which I think is original, that currencies are likely to become the last great equilibrating mechanism in the financial markets. And if you look back through history, not just the past 10 years, not just the ERM crises, but there have been many, many parabolic moves in currencies. And I think, you know, we're ripe for many of those over the next few years. And it's important to think about, you know, what they could be, how they can transpire, and really think outside the box.
Okay, perfect. And when just to sum it up, you think that the Turkish trade will play out within the next 3 to 6 months? If I'm correct,
My time frame for Turkey is the next 3 to 6 months. That I would expect, in a good way, for the levers of allowing, you know, an open economy, highly dependent upon tourism, impacted by the shock of COVID-19, to gradually have the currency depreciate. The risk is a parabolic move if, as you said, some of those liabilities and weaknesses in the macroeconomic structure are exposed in a less benign global economic environment.
So thank you, John. Thank you. Let's thank the viewers for watching. It was great talking to you. I think we should do this again in 3 to 6 months to see how this trade has gone. I'm on your side on this trade. I think it's going to work out. The only risk I see, it's maybe not 3 months, maybe 6 months, because my experience has shown that Turkey takes a bit more time to play out usually. But it was great having you. Great talking.
That's right. It always takes longer, but when it goes faster and farther than you thought.
I agree fully. Nice.
Thanks so much, Michael.
Have a great day.
Great to chat with you.